teachers, the fact that they have equal access to all those things doesn't give them equal access to education if they don't understand the language that they're being taught in. So it mandated that children be specifically and formally taught English. And then that, in the ensuing years, came to lead to bilingual education, which meant children would be taught in their own language and English, which leads us to what we have today. But Lao was the floor, and not the ceiling, the floor. It was what got kids who didn't speak English what they need in schools.
And where does bilingual education in Los Angeles stand today?
What we have in Los Angeles today, it's called dual language education. It used to be called something that was transitional. Kids were taught in Armenian or Spanish or whatever until they spoke enough English to do well in an English class. Now, a dual language program means children are taught in their native language and in English all the way through grade 12, should their parents choose. And they graduate as bilingual, biliterate children. English-speaking children are in those programs as well. We currently have 8 languages that are honored with that program. We have Spanish, Korean, Mandarin, Armenian, Arabic, French, Japanese, and American Sign Language. That is our newest language.
On that note, Cheryl Ortega, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
It was a pleasure.
Likewise. Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esti Chandler. Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip is getting worse by the day. While public opinion worldwide has shifted considerably, Israeli leaders have chosen a scorched earth campaign intended to make Gaza uninhabitable. A United Nations Relief and Works Agency official reported this week that the UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees can no longer provide services in northern Gaza, citing staff shortages and a collapse of social order amid Israeli attacks on civilians and restrictions on food and aid access that have left the population starving. An Israeli strike on a home housing displaced Palestinians killed at least 24 people in Gaza's Deir al-Balah on Friday. Gaza's health ministry reported that 104 people were killed and 160 injured in Israeli attacks between Thursday and Friday afternoon, according to the latest situation report from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And Palestine state news agency WAFA reports that Israeli forces continue to raid villages, towns, and cities across the occupied West Bank, searching homes and assaulting locals resisting incursions. Very much wanting to speak with someone who has been in the region this week, we are grateful that a wonderful friend of the show, Hassan El-Tayab, who just recently returned from a trip to the region, is with us today to share his experience and takeaways. Hassan El-Tayab is an author, songwriter, and the legislative director for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. He's a former co-director of the national advocacy group Just Foreign Policy, where he led their lobbying work to advance a more progressive foreign policy in the Middle East and Latin America, and played a major role in the successful passage of the War Powers Resolution to end U.S. military aid to the Saudi-UAE coalition's war in Yemen. Hassan's writings and commentaries have been featured in numerous news outlets, including CNN, BBC World News, The Hill, Al Jazeera, and The Intercept, among others. It is always a great pleasure to welcome Hassan El-Tayab back to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you so much for that warm introduction, Esti. Great to be back on with you.
We love having you on the show, Hassan. Upon your return from the Middle East, you and Bridget Moigt, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, wrote an essay, Six Lessons from a Wartime Journey to Israel-Palestine. The first being what has become a mantra for many of us. And polls show that upwards of 68% of all Americans and 80% of Democrats agree is needed immediately, which is an immediate and permanent ceasefire. Can you talk about what you heard from Palestinians in the region about that?
Yeah, thank you again for having me on. This was a truly incredible trip, something I will not forget. We were there for a couple weeks in January. Intense is the word that comes to mind, and the most militarized environment I've ever personally been in. Calls for a ceasefire were on the lips of virtually all Palestinians and a lot of Israeli human rights activists that we met with. You know, these trips are, you know, kind of a whirlwind. I met with so many folks, but I think my time with the Ramallah Friends School students kind of left the biggest impact on me in seeing how the trauma of this war is really just devastating these children. While we were at the Ramallah Friends School, a sixth grade Palestinian student handed me a folded note saying, "Palestine's witnessing a genocide right now. A child's dying every 5 minutes. Gaza needs a break. The people of Palestine are desperate for a ceasefire, which will allow them to get supplies like food, water, and medical kits, unquote. And it's just heartbreaking. So many of these kids just cried to me. And we, you know, I was at a loss for words. Like, my country's complicit through our military funding and weapon sales to the government of Israel. And we need to do more. We know that, you know, over 30,000 people have been killed and counting. We know that there are tens of thousands more wounded, trapped under the rubble. We know that Israeli hostages remain in captivity and that the UN is warning of famine if urgent action is not taken to immediately open up humanitarian access. And people are starving, as you said, in the north where there's no aid access. More war is not the answer. We need a ceasefire now. And that's what we need to protect Palestinians and Israelis and ensure the safe return of these hostages who have been held captive for months and months. And, you know, to finally address this exploding humanitarian crisis. And I'm really glad that you mentioned the statistics of how many U.S. citizens are calling their representatives for a ceasefire. And it's critical that that momentum continue.
You know, for months, the Biden administration has said that their goal is to prevent regional escalation. Yet we read about escalations nearly every week. What kind of diplomacy is happening towards de-escalation? And what did you learn about that on your trip?
Yeah, I wish more diplomacy was being done right now. And yes, you're right. So the administration is saying that it's their goal to prevent this escalation. But while we were there at that, you know, in the region, it was very, very clear that this regional war is already here and it's getting worse by the day. We made a decision not to fly to Iraq due to IRGC airstrikes. We learned about, you know, how the U.S. struck Houthi targets in Yemen while we were at dinner with faith leaders in Bethlehem. Israel and Hezbollah continue to trade strikes, you know, at the Lebanese border with Israel, and there's a mounting death toll there. Settler violence, Israeli military raids are escalating. It was the first time I'd ever been in an environment where there was air raid sirens going off. And, you know, those shriek through the old city of Jerusalem. And, you know, and just being there in such a militarized environment, it's like, what can you say? We have to end this crisis. And we know that all of these events that I just listed are directly connected to the war in Gaza and will only continue unless there is a ceasefire and robust regional dialogue. So, you know, more strikes on Yemen, we know that's not going to actually help shipping in the Red Sea. We know that. Biden even said it publicly, yet they continue to pursue this policy. And it's the literal definition of insanity when you you know, keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. So, you know, we need the ceasefire. We need to end this. And I think, you know, and everybody knows it. We just need to finalize this and hopefully before Ramadan.
Yeah, good point. I know the terrifying shrill of those Israeli air raid sirens. As I mentioned in the opening, UNRWA can no longer provide services in the north, as you also said. And President Biden has shamefully not restored funding to UNRWA because of unproven claims by Israel that a handful of the agency's workers took part in the attacks on the 7th of October. Can you tell us what you learned on the ground and any information you might have obtained since you returned about getting desperately needed food, water, and medical supplies into Gaza, as we read about aid trucks remaining lined up for miles, blocked from delivering their loads?
Yeah, such an important question right now as the hunger crisis just spirals. So I think a critical thing that people need to understand about UNRWA is that it's not just a normal aid organization. They are the backbone of all humanitarian aid delivery in Gaza. So if they're not stocking those shelves of the warehouses and allowing other groups like Oxfam, USAID, and others to really like use those facilities to get their aid out there, it's not happening. And we know that this is an acute crisis. I can't stress enough. So I met with the West Bank UNRWA director while I was there. I met with several UNRWA staffers who are doing, you know, on the ground delivery, communications, fundraising. So I got a sample size of UNRWA staff, and they are so dedicated and passionate, and they're doing such incredible things under duress. Just they're risking their lives. Settlers have been attacking UNRWA trucks and UN trucks. So they know that there are even targets, yet they continue to go out in the field and provide this assistance. So I wanted to just start there. I caught a shuttle with UNRWA from Jerusalem into Jordan on my last day. They were nice enough to let me hitch a ride and get through the Allenby Bridge. And during that time, this woman, Nisreen, this UNRWA staffer, told me about her work and off hours to evacuate kids from Gaza who are in critical condition for medical treatment. And these folks had, amputated limbs, severe burns across their body. She showed me all these pictures. I mean, it was just horrifying and something I'll never forget. In total, they've been able to save more than 50 kids with an adult, getting them safe passage into Egypt, Turkey, Jordan, Oman, Qatar. And they're doing this just by contacting these embassies. They're just bootstrapping it. And I was just so impressed that, like, one person after another, it's not to get into, I don't know if you've heard the starfish story.
I haven't.
So there's a kid. You know, all these starfish are washed up against the beach, and, you know, there's this kid tossing one by one, there's like tens of thousands of starfish, and some guy says, "Hey, well, why are you doing that? You'll never save them all." He's like, "Well, it mattered to that one." Throws in another one, "Mattered to that one." And I just am blown away by this person. And, you know, I said, "Hey, you are just so inspiring to me." She's like, "I'm doing it to surrender to the fact that there is no justice." And you're
amen
right.
Like, to listen, that.
Yeah. I was just so blown away by her. And here's the kicker is that she told us that there's a hospital in Florida that they're able to evacuate kids to, but the kids don't want to go because they're afraid of Americans and they're afraid of America for what we're doing and the complicity that we have right now in this horrific, atrocities unfolding. And that should concern every American. I don't know what else to say. It's like, we do not want children that have third degree burns over their whole body, saying that they would rather take their chances in Gaza than come to a U.S. hospital.
An excellent story for people to leave on the White House hotline. You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK. I'm Esti Chandler, so grateful to be joined today by Hassan El-Tayyab, Legislative Director for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. We're discussing his recent trip to the Middle East and the six takeaways he wrote about in his essay with Bridget Moy, Six Lessons from Our Wartime Journey to Israel-Palestine. As you're all keenly aware, KPFK is a listener-supported public radio station that is part of the Pacifica Network. We are about to celebrate our 75th anniversary of being on the air, a considerable milestone for an independent media network whose idea was born out of a detention camp where conscientious objectors to war were being forcibly detained during the Second World War. As I learned recently from one of my favorite Pacifica shows, Letters in Politics, hosted by the fantastic Mitch Jezerich, KPFK is the second station created as part of the Pacifica Network, a network created by people who were alarmed by the power that large corporations and governments had in shaping the stories that we're told and in shaping the public narrative. We are a radio station and a radio network that took the bold move, deciding not to rely on corporations or our government for funding through advertising and underwriting, but instead have for all these years relied on the communities that we serve, both by having people donate their time and labor to the station and also by asking our community to donate whatever they can afford to keep the lights on and the station running. That is how this tradition of public broadcasting and this community that we are all a part of today was created. It's not easy to operate with an alternative model in the capitalistic world we live in, but with your support, we persist. So I'm asking you now to help us keep going by calling 818-985-5735 or by logging on to kpfk.org to make a one-time donation or by becoming a member of our Sustainer Circle and making a monthly donation. We're very happy to be offering signed copies of our recent guest, Israeli activist and scholar Maya Wynn's brand new book, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom, which dropped this month, and we are offering for a $75 donation. Again, the number is 818-985-5735. We also have one copy of the very popular Ilan Pape book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, available today only. It will get shipped to you today for a $150 donation. Again, the number to ask for that is 818-985-5735. Hassan, in spite of the evidence shown when South Africa presented their case against the Israeli government at the International Court of Justice, Israeli militants continue to perpetuate mass atrocities. Is there anything that you can tell us about efforts by our government or others to use the immense leverage that we hold because of all the aid that we give to them to end those atrocities?
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, as we arrived in Israel, the ICJ case was just opening up. And, you know, on our first evening, an Israeli human rights leader from Hamoked told us that that we were just so much more informed than so much of the Israeli public, and the narratives are not getting out there. But when we chatted with Palestinians, the ICJ case was like the Palestinian Super Bowl. Everybody was watching it closely, getting as much information, you know, saying plugged in to Middle East Eye and Al Jazeera, and really just so much going on. But it was clear that it's clear that the U.S. is not doing enough to rein in the Israeli government as it's, you know, potentially committing genocide, according to the ICJ. Clearly, the aid delivery is not happening, and that needs to increase. And we have so much leverage. We have weapon sales. We have economic support. We have diplomatic support, making public statements. So it's not enough is being done. We have a lot of levers, and we need more action from the administration. They have taken a few steps to sanction settlers. That I think that's significant, needs to keep going, but Gaza is bleeding out right now and facing possible ethnic cleansing after an invasion into Rafah, which could push all of these 1.4 million Palestinians into the Sinai Desert, where the Egyptian government, according to satellite images, is actively building a potentially permanent refugee camp in the desert, which is just such a disaster and immense loss of life. We need to use all available tools to make sure this does not happen.
Right, because sanctioning a handful of settlers is clearly not enough. Your fifth takeaway that you wrote about is the U.S. should become complicit in peace, not more war. Many of us continue to engage in large and small-scale direct actions pushing for that, our government really seems intransigent in ending our material support for this genocide. What did you hear from people you spoke with in the region? And how can we, citizens, help organizations like yours to continue to push towards that goal?
Thank you so much for this question. Kids, especially kids at the Ramallah Friends School, continue to ask, why is the United States continuing to support this by sending bombs and military aid? And, probably half a dozen kids cried to me and asked questions just like this, including the third grade cousin of the Ramallah Friends School grad who remains paralyzed after being shot in November. And he said, hey, can you tell, through tears, he was crying in front of his whole class, saying, stop crimes of hate against Palestinians. I mean, just absolutely horrific. We need, as citizens, to press our members of Congress to vote no on the Israel supplemental. I mean, it's a whole complicated negotiation going on, but we cannot be sending more military assistance at this time. It's just a basic ask for members. We don't want our tax dollars funding this. So I would urge people to, message their members, ask for that, and also support Senator Sanders' 502B resolution to investigate Israeli human rights abuses in Gaza and the West Bank. We had a vote in January, 12 senators got on, and, there's momentum there to be had as well.
I just heard in the last half hour Ralph Nader refer to that as the genocide tax, which I think is great framing. Lastly, in our last couple minutes, you wrote about spending time with the Carter Center's Israel-Palestine team in Ramallah. Did anything you heard there or from others give you hope that you can share with us today that there is, in fact, a clear path being offered towards a just and lasting peace for Palestinians and Israelis?
Yeah, that was such a fascinating time spending, going around meeting folks with Carter Center's Israel-Palestine team. They took me to a showing of ICEP, or Institute for Social and Economic Progress. They had a poll, showed that 57% of Palestinians in East Jerusalem, West Bank want, a two-state solution. They want their own country. And also, if there were an election, Marwan Barghouti, the imprisoned Intifada leader, would actually beat Hamas with almost 70% of the vote. And many have referred to him as the Nelson Mandela of Palestine. We met Marwan's wife, Fadwa, and they're renewing the campaign to get him out. And the day I met Fadwa, Apple TV showed a film, Tomorrow's Freedom. So I would urge people just look into that and also understand, a bit more. And the U.S. has an obligation to invest seriously in peace, both the immediate negotiations and ceasefire, but also this long-term sustainability, including Palestinians and their hopes and dreams for the future into this future scenario. And the way forward must include Palestinians. So anyway, thank you so much for having me on. This has been a great conversation.
We can't thank you enough for being such a great friend of the show. As Hassan and Bridget wrote, quote, "So often you hear people in D.C. talking about day after scenarios in Gaza. Many of these ideas omit one key element, Palestinian perspectives and dreams for their future. While the challenges ahead are immense, lawmakers must look for willing partners in peace and stability to advance shared goals. There is still time for an independent Palestinian state, and the international community must create space for Palestinians to determine their future." End quote. As we are all keenly aware, this is an incredibly perilous time for Palestinians, and sadly also for independent media reporting on their plight, and quite frankly, for the truth itself. But it is a time of genocide for Palestinians in Gaza, and we desperately want to be able to keep bringing you these important voices on this international emergency, like that of our dear friend Hassan El-Tayyab. So I'm asking you to please help us do that by making our phones ring, by calling in to make a pledge at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735, or by logging on to kpfk.org. KPFK and the Pacifica Network have always lived on the edge and have even gone off the air a few times due to lack of funding. But we really cannot allow that to happen now. So as we get ready to mark our 75th year on the air next month, and Negwa and I will soon be marking our 10th anniversary since the one and only Don Bustani passed the microphone at Middle East in Focus off to us, I'm asking you to please help us get there. Help us continue this tradition with a donation of whatever amount you can afford according to your means. We are very happy to have this one copy of Ilan Pape's The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine that can get shipped out to you today for a $150 donation. And we have several copies of Israeli activist and scholar Maya Wynn's brand new book, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom, for a $75 donation. Naomi Klein writes about Towers of Ivory and Steel, quote, "From the development of deadly weapons to the crafting of state propaganda to the training of officers, there is no escaping the conclusion that these universities are part and parcel of the official infrastructure that has enabled Israel to systematically avoid the political solutions that are the only hope of enduring peace in the region." An explosive contribution from a brilliant young scholar, end quote. These are the expert voices we are consistently able to bring you. Hassan El-Tayyab, Naomi Klein, Maya Wind, Phyllis Bennis, and many, many more. Please help us continue the mission of KPFK by calling 818-985-5735 now to request a copy, a signed copy of Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom, or to make a one-time or reoccurring donation by logging on to kpfk.org and joining our Sustainers Circle. Once again, I want to thank our guest, the wonderful Hassan El-Tayyab, Legislative Director for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. I highly, highly recommend following him on Twitter. I also want to thank Gary Baca for his production support today. Our theme song is the Overture for Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esty Chandler, thanking you for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus. And I want to thank Edie and David in Northridge for your generous contribution today.